I think most cow-calf producers who sell conventionally to at the sale barn to a feedlot, I think they take really good care of their cows, honestly, because you have to keep a cow in really good condition for her to calve each year.
Welcome to another episode of the Ancestral Mind Podcast. I'm Brent Philbin, and you know we're going to be here with Colin Stuckert. And also today, we are going to be speaking with Lauren Stein. Who is Lauren Stein? We'll tell you in a second. But remember, at the Ancestral Mind Podcast, we cover all things health from an ancestral perspective. We want to help you build an ancestral mind so you can think about the decisions you make on a daily basis while considering the first principles of what makes you human. We are here to wake people up to the mismatch of our current environment so we can hopefully reverse the trend of declining health currently overtaking our species. So, how are we going to help you reverse that trend today? We are speaking with Lauren Stein. Lauren Stein gave up the glamorous, amazing life of an attorney and moved out to the country to start her own farm. Do you think she regrets that decision? Probably not, since she's on this episode of The Ancestral Mind. But stick around, you're going to learn everything from how to rotate your pastures to what happens when somebody steals your goat. I don't know. It was an interesting story, and there's a twist that you might not be expecting. So stick around. This is episode number 37 of The Ancestral Mind Podcast. All right. Yeah, once again, we are here on The Ancestral Mind Podcast. And today we're going to be, as we just said, speaking with Lauren Stein. Lauren, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much.
And of course, Colin's here.
Hey, what's
Colin
up?
Stuckert, the host of the Ancestral Mind Podcast. We'll introduce him as like an afterthought. But
they know who I am.
But before we even get into the nitty gritty, this is going to be fun. I've got a lot of cool stuff that I want to ask Lauren that Colin doesn't even know about.
Because I told Brent to prepare for the show and he did, it looks like.
Yeah, so I prepare for every show. You just never let me talk over you. And so anyway, Lauren, tell us about you. Enough of our bickering. Let us know who you are and tell us why you're awesome.
Okay. Well, I'm in Northwest Arkansas. I was originally born and raised in California. I lived there for the first 31 years of my life, and I was an attorney in private practice and just doing basic civil litigation, mostly plaintiff's work, car accidents, medical malpractice, all that kind of stuff. And I liked being a lawyer, but I felt pretty dissatisfied with, you know, thinking that for the next 35 years of my life, I'm just going to sit in this office and, you know, have people spend lots of money on what are sometimes kind of petty legal issues that they're trying to solve. Mm-hmm. And then the people who often really need legal help can't afford it. And so I was just starting to get a little frustrated, just not enjoying my career. And I actually got to the point where my law firm was downsizing, needed to fire people. And I ended up being one of the people they let go. And I think it's because at that point, my attitude had gotten so bad. I was so unhappy mm-hmm. with what I was mm-hmm. doing. And I took it as an opportunity to come to the University of Arkansas School of Law, which has a master's program in food and agricultural law and policy. I'd always been interested in food. You know, I was one of the very typical CrossFit people who started looking into the diet connection in your health and, you know, how can you feel better, work out better, be healthier, be safer. And so that kind of took me on a journey into farming and food and agriculture. And I grew up in a rural place in California. And I kind of blame my dad for making me watch Western movies so much, but I always wanted cows. Mm. Like, there's not a single farmer mm-hmm. in my family, not a single one. And so I always thought, I'll just buy a farm when I'm retired. You know, obviously, I can't possibly make money doing it now. I have to have a responsible adult career. And so I came to Arkansas to do this master's program, and I ended up falling in love with Arkansas. That's the weirdest thing for me to say, is like a California girl through and through. And I met these two farmers on a farm tour. And their kids don't want to farm. They raise livestock, pasture raised, grass fed, organic principles, and direct market locally. And I just kind of started shadowing them and said, well, if I'm going to be a lawyer working in food and agriculture, I need to know what farming's like. It's kind of silly for me to advocate for policies or regulate this industry if I don't know what farmers actually experience. And so, long story short, 4 years later, we say that I'm still on the farm tour and I'm actually now a partner in the business. I bought my own farm. Mm. In December, I've got a pretty big
herd. The same business you went on tour with?
Yeah, they brought me in because, you know, their kids don't want to farm. And I understand that. You shouldn't farm if you don't want to, because it's really mm-hmm. brutal some days. But
the lifestyle.
Yes. And they've built this incredible business. Like, you know, we have a huge client list. We serve all these restaurants and they don't want to see it go away anytime soon. And so myself and then another beginning farmer who's about my same age, we're kind of in queue to sort of take over the reins as they start to slow down. So long story short, now I'm farming in Arkansas and I teach classes at the University of Arkansas and a bunch of different legal topics like food labeling, animal welfare, things like that. But the way you found me and what I think I do mostly now is journalism, writing about food, writing about our food system and different issues in that. And I write for AgFunder about a lot of technology that we're starting to see come into agriculture and how that plays out.
So have you seen the show Yellowstone?
I haven't. I want to. I don't know where to watch it.
You need to watch it. So if you're like, if you as a kid wanted cows, you watch that show and you want a ranch, you want cows, you want horses, you want everything. And it's like, I just bought 10 acres actually outside of Austin and we're actually going to be moving to a little bit of the farm life. Right. And so I'm very interested in all that, of course, but I'm telling you, watch Yellowstone. It's so good.
Where do and I Kevin find Costner's it? Great. I don't know how to find it.
You might have to like prime it. Okay. Find on Prime, okay. But it's a great show. Everyone should watch. So there's a plug for that. Free plug.
Great.
They totally paid us for that.
I'm curious though. So you got into food and ag law because you're just interested in food. And like, what did that look like? Were you like going to take on corporate clients? Were you going to like, was a path to become a farmer, then know the law side so you could write about it? I mean, it seems like a kind of a winding path to what you're doing today.
You sound like my dad. Yes, it's a very winding path where he just kept saying, what are you doing? Like, why don't you just...
Yeah, right? You don't always know what's going to work.
Right, but, and know. I wish I had some really intelligent answer for you about this was my master plan, but I kind of just jumped off the cliff and said, we're just going to figure out how to fly as we go. And awesome. I started freelance writing when I left private practice to kind of support me while I was in the master's program. And I love writing. I've always liked it. And I never intended to be a journalist, but in the last 5 years, you know, I get most of my income now from writing and it's just sort of developed from that.
Wow.
I never planned a farm. Like I said, I thought I was going to have to wait till I retired at like 70 to buy land and buy some cows. But my two mentors, Ann and Ron, they're incredible. And when my master's program ended, I was supposed to move back to California. And I said to him one day, I said, I don't want to go. Like, I kind of want to stay here and buy some livestock and do this for real. And I could never buy a farm in California. I mean, the prices of land are just astronomical. Like, what I got here, the 40 acres I'm on, like, there's no way I could afford that in my wildest dreams. And so it was probably the toughest decision I ever had to make, you know, to call everybody I know back in California and be like, hey, I'm just not coming home. I'm going to stay here and farm. And a lot of people had a hard time processing that.
Yeah, right.
And I think maybe to some extent I did too. Like, wow, am I really just going to farm and teach classes and write? And I wasn't quite sure if I could support myself doing it, which is kind of those things where you wake up every day and you go as hard as you can. And before you know it, 4 years pass and you look around and, you know, you've actually created a new career path for yourself.
Yeah. I have so many questions. Like, I don't, this show wasn't going to be about farming, but that's like where I want to take
it. Yeah, I knew you were going to go that way. You're so, like, oh, I'm only going to talk about the article. Yeah, right.
Well, just for the audience listening, just so we can give them a little teaser for the end of the show or at the middle or wherever we get to it. So the article is titled My Beef with Plant-Based Proteins Half Truce. And I found this on, I believe it was Instagram, Reddit, reached right out to Lauren, like, we got to talk, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And we're going to definitely get into some of this stuff about a lot of what's going on in labeling and the new, you know, plant-based movement and how beef's getting a bad rap a lot of times unjustly and how, like, with everything that's in pop culture or that's, you know, common knowledge, there's a lot of pieces missing to the puzzle. And so I want to really talk about that. But I'm just really curious since we're talking about farms right now. So 40 acres, right? And you're going to have cows, chickens, sheep, maybe? Like, are you limiting to a couple animals? You're doing a lot? And are you going to do it yourself? You're going to have an employee?
Yeah. So I've already got almost 100 animals here. I already owned livestock before I bought this place. So my mentors combined have 170 acres. And before, so I used a USDA program because I didn't have the down payment. And so through a USDA FSA program, if you can show that you have 3 years of experience managing a farming operation, there's this cool program where they pay the down payment for you. And so through
on the property,
yeah. So through working with Ozark Pasture Beef with my mentors, I had 3 years of managerial experience. Like, it got to the point where I was helping them make management decisions. I was taking animals to the processor. I had bought a small herd of meat goats, which has now grown up to be a pretty big herd. I was talking to customers, working with customers, talking to restaurants. So that was really the main reason I was able to buy this piece of land. And since I already had some livestock, you know, I brought my goats over. And then my mentors brought some of their cows over so I could start rehabilitating this land. It had been continuously grazed and overstocked. And so it needs a little bit of TLC, but right now I've got the temporary fence everywhere and I'm trying to do kind of a rotational grazing system with just temporary fence to sort of get the pastures back in good condition. So I've got about 15 head of cattle here. I've got close to 40 goats. I've got two sheep, which are just bottle babies. They belong in the sheep flock, but I had to bottle feed them through winter. And now they're just basically like dogs. And then I've got a lot of ducks and geese and a pet turkey and a mule. So there's already quite a pretty big population here.
And so they're all pasture raised?
Every single one. And yeah.
Okay, so can you speak on real quick, unless you have a question before I can go?
I've never heard the phrase pet turkey before. That's
his name's
like, well, yeah, farmers have pets that are not dogs or cats.
That's right. Like, his name's the governor, and he's really sweet. And yeah, his name's the governor. My mule's name is Dusty. I name every single one of my goats. I love naming things. And I think it's because I am a writer. And so a lot of farmers use the numerical system, and we use numbers to tag our cattle and our sheep. But goats have so much personality. And so I have this weird naming convention where every year I follow the alphabet. Like this year was S, and so I named every goat kid born.
Like hurricanes, right?
Yeah. So yeah, basically, like right. So I picked S names this year. Next year will be T. It's the writer in me. I love words and I love wordplay.
Does that make it harder when it comes to slaughter?
You know, people ask me that, but for me, it actually really honors each animal. Like I don't ever want to get to the point where they're just kind of a rote widget in the system.
Yep.
You know, and so that animal, I know everything about it. I've been with it since the day it was born. I drive it to the processor. Like I could tell you every time it was sick. I could tell you every time that it got its head stuck in a fence. So the name to me is kind of an honor in some way. Like you weren't just.
Yeah. I mean, celebrate the life, right? Like, cause that's what it's about. Like animals that live better, not only do they taste better, they're better for you, but they have better lives.
Yes.
Like it's not just about like. The fact that, I mean, all animals in nature die. They all kill each other. And I'm watching the show on Netflix called Africa. Nature's brutal.
It's
right?
Unapologetically
farm animals
violent.
That are,
yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. And so farm animals that live like on pasture, that live really good lives, like they have it made. They're living in luxury.
Oh, I wrote a whole short story about this because people always say like, how can you butcher these animals? I'm like, I have seen animals die in such horrific ways. Like my butcher.
And suffer.
Yes. And, my butcher shooting this animal and it instantly dying is my preference any single day of the week because it means I kept it safe and healthy for the entire time that it was my responsibility. But, you know, when there's a predator attack or some kind of sudden illness or when, you know, someone dies during birth, I mean, that's the stuff that really just kind of tears you apart because there's nothing you could have done to really stop that.
Yeah. Well, and even if an animal gets sick or something happens on the farm, you can be there to comfort and do things that in the wild, they would have literally bled to death or starved to death or been eaten alive to death.
Yeah.
You know, there's people they have this illusion of what nature actually is because we've been able to control so much of it. And really people have no freaking idea.
No, I've got two Pyrenees that live outside 24/7 and they guard my goats. And people always say, oh, don't you bring them inside? First of all, I'm like, no, they smell like cow manure. They're disgusting. And they don't want to be inside.
Right.
But they hunt. And I've seen them kill rabbits and eat the rabbit before the rabbit's actually dead. And people looking like, oh, Bobby's so sweet. He's such a doll. And I'm like, not really.
Yesterday.
Not really.
So you mentioned your goats have guards basically here. These guys are protecting them.
Yep.
So they're not very good at their job, though, apparently, because if I read the title of that podcast right, you managed to get one stolen.
Yeah,
how did that happen? Like, what
stolen goat? Is that what happened?
Are we going? You want me to take you down the path of the stolen goat?
We might as well.
Okay. We're talking about goats.
We might as well.
Seemed like a good spot.
Okay,
we'll circle back. We'll circle back.
So I post a lot on Instagram. I try and use Instagram to show consumers like what farm life is like, how we raise these animals, like a lot of educational stuff, and stupid hashtags. I guess I don't know a lot about hashtags, but I used one that was Goats of Anarchy. And I just thought it was funny because if you've ever raised goats, like they're right, it's funny. And goats are
Goats of Anarchy.
They're so rebellious. Yeah. They're manipulative. They're always trying to escape. They're very naughty. You know,
yeah.
They're
yeah. They get into stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I thought it was hilarious. And then I get this message from this woman who says, "How dare you use our hashtag?" And I'm just bewildered that how do you own a hashtag? The lawyer in me came out where I'm like, no, you don't.
Right. You don't is the answer, right. But you know.
Yeah. It turns out, unbeknownst to me, that Ghosts of Anarchy is actually a vegan goat sanctuary in New Jersey.
Oh my gosh.
Right.
So do they just not let the vegan, the goats ever die? Like, do they like prolong their lives indefinitely? I mean, you know.
I encourage you to go look at it. And this is just my two cents, but they have a lot of goats that have had amputations, that are in wheelchairs, that have other disabilities. And when I have an animal that's sick or injured, I fight like hell to keep that animal alive as long as they're fighting. But there are instances where, you know, not everything that's born is genetically going to thrive. There are certain situations where we'll have twins or triplets or quadruplets born in the goats. And if there's quadruplets, I kind of know there's probably going to be one that's not going to do really well. And it might die. Mm-hmm. I might have to bottle feed it. But they keep these goats in these air-conditioned barns. They get bucket rations. It looks like they're not really on grass. And there's really a lot of anthropomorphizing, I think, of... And then I tend to think a lot of people now, because of goat yoga, are assuming that goats are like dogs and cats. And they're thinking them more like a companion animal. And when people tell me I have pet goats, I get so bothered by it. Because pet goats on like a quarter acre in a chain link fence backyard is not where they were meant to be.
Yep.
I'm on a tangent. Back to the stolen goat. So these people, basically, I posted about a goat that I decided to butcher. She was a nanny goat. She was 5 years old. And she was just not a very good genetic specimen. She was not keeping weight well. Horrible mother. She'd give birth and walk away. Just drop her kids and not take care of them. And she'd get her head stuck in a fence a lot. She just was not fitting in this system. And I didn't. They passed those genetics on to their kids. And so... I feel a big ethical responsibility as a livestock producer to cull those genetics. And a lot of people would have just sold her to someone else so that they could keep breeding her. But I think that's really irresponsible. If you cull one goat with problems now, you save the rest of that lineage from having to keep proliferating those problems, those genetic problems. But she shared my Instagram to her 600,000 followers and said, "This is how a farmer thinks." And I was in weaning at that time, and I showed this picture of the nanny on one side of the fence and the goat kids on the other side. And so these 600,000 vegans just immediately attacked me. Like, all this, like, "I hope you die. Like, I hope your family dies. Like, you're so cool."
It's terrible what they do.
It is. And they kept saying, like, "Please let us just buy this goat." I'm like, "No, this goat is going to get butchered, and this meat will feed my community. Like, this is meat that people here want to eat. They're looking for local, humanely raised, high welfare meat. I'm not going to give you this so you can shove her in your barn until she dies." Mm-hmm. And so one Saturday I was sitting in my office and I had the curtains drawn and I kind of heard a car pull up the driveway and I was on the phone, didn't think anything of it. I went out that afternoon and she was gone. And she had been right up here in front of my house. I'm pointing. Mm-hmm. I know you don't know where I'm pointing, but my window in my office faces the entire 40 acres. I can see a lot from up here. And she was right up here in a pen. And I can't say without a shadow of a doubt, because I don't have hard evidence, I combed this place for like 2 days. Like, where did this goat go? I know this goat did not get stolen, but the only thing I can come to is that they came here and someone took her. And it's very easy to find people's addresses and property records and tax records. Mm. And, you know, on a 40-acre farm, there's lots of ways to sneak in. It's not like I've got, you know, guard towers and chain link fence. So I think they honestly just came up here and took this goat. And I have not found that goat to this day. I've not heard anything about this goat.
How long ago was this?
I want to say July. And I felt really unsafe. Sorry. Like, I was really taken aback by how violated I felt, knowing that someone came here. And like I said, I'm pretty sure, like, my gut tells me that's what happened. But of course, without hard evidence, I can't say 100%. But she's just not here. Mm-hmm. No body, no hide, no evidence of a predator. None of the, and it's odd because they took the exact goat they knew I was going to butcher. So it just, it's all too coincidental for me to feel like something didn't happen.
Well, the vegan community is big enough where you can have people all over that see Instagram posts or whatever, you know, so it might not,
610 is a lot of followers.
It might not have been a long trek for them to just like do that or whatever.
Right. To call up somebody and say, "Go find this chick, take this goat."
Right. Right. So Slow Down Farmstead. I'm not sure if you follow her account, but
I love her account. Girl crush. Amazing account, girl crush, right? Yes.
She's super private, though, for reasons like that, though.
Yeah.
Because she gets a lot of that vegan, I mean, like literal death threats, which I think is appalling and absurd in so many
ways. It's also pretty ironic.
It's very ironic. I don't know, like,
think about that. All of it's ironic.
And I've heard that a lot of vegans will actually kill livestock, and their justification is that we don't want the farmer to profit off the death. Like, we know that we can't keep this animal, so they'll poison them or kill them or something like that. And it's just, it is such a deep fundamental disconnection with nature. And that's what's odd to me is vegans say, like, "Oh, we're all about nature," but like, you are so far removed from your place.
No, you're not. In this chain. You literally don't even understand that. All of it. Right. So this actually is a good segue because I wanted to get into the differences between how to raise livestock, how it's typically done, and some of that. Like, because a lot of consumers might see like the trigger words like humanely raised or pasture or whatever. And even those words don't have standard definitions in a lot of cases. And there's a lot of nonsense. I mean, you know better than anyone. Hopefully you can actually educate me in some things that I can tell people. But there's a lot of nonsense when it comes to food labeling and farming, and there's not a lot of checks and balances and stuff. So like, can you talk about what it is like for like the ideal way to raise pasture animals and how to give, you know, an animal a healthy, happy life, which in a lot of instances includes like how much space they have and not just their diet or whether they go outside once a day or whatever?
Yeah, I think for me, and you could ask many different pastured livestock farmers what their take is on this. And, you know, we'd all have maybe slightly different answers, but I think what it comes down to for me and what my mentors have taught me is that what would this animal be doing in its natural habitat if we weren't involved? Mm-hmm. Yep. And so, for example, the reason I bought the farm I bought is because it's on the side of a mountain. There's lots of woods, there's lots of trees and shrubs, and it's really rocky. And that's ideal goat habitat. Like, this is, goats will thrive. They love rocks. They love to be up high on a mountain. They love to eat blackberry bushes and little trees and shrubs and all that kind of nasty stuff that cows don't eat. There's plenty of pasture here for them too. So they will eat some grass and stuff. But I think it is providing these animals with as close to their natural habitat as they would seek out in the wild. And that's kind of funny with goats because goats are desert animals. And I'm in Northwest Arkansas and our winters get pretty nasty. And so, you know, they aren't as happy during winter. And, you know, mm-hmm. I could put them in a barn, but then there's lots of health issues when you put them all in a barn and they're in their own feces all the time and they don't go outside mm-hmm. as much. So I pretty much keep them outside 365 days of the year, and they've got tons of shelter in the woods. So if we've got a huge storm or something like that, they just hunker down in the woods, and it's not as bad as people think, you know. And I also tend to think that if you keep bringing them in a barn and then putting them outside, that transition is kind of hard on them. You know, whereas if they are outside, they just get acclimated, they grow a huge thick hair coat, and they're pretty warm. And, you know, I think we have to intervene to some extent when it comes to their natural habitat, because we have to make sure they're getting adequate nutrition. So, for example, if we've got a pretty severe drought year, we're going to have to supplement with hay a lot sooner than we would. And I do feed hay a couple months out of the year just because the grass stops growing at a certain point. And there's other things we can give them. There's like a molasses protein lick tub sometimes right before kidding season that I give them just to make sure they have the calories and nutrition they need right before they come into milk and start nursing. So there are some things we modify about that natural behavior cycle. But I think on a daily basis, most of us are striving to give them as much freedom to just live and exist and to engage in the things they want to engage in. You know, my goats have a specific route they take through the farm. If I don't have any temporary fencing up, they follow the same pattern every day. And I think that's really funny. And I think that's probably what they would want to do in the wild. You know, they hunker down at night, they wake up, they go out to graze, they seek shade in the late afternoon, they go graze again, and they go back to the same spot. I don't even tell them, they go to the same spot every night to go to sleep. And it's just a very interesting behavioral thing to observe.
And so you don't do much, like you don't do anything to fatten them up or like add grains at certain times of the year. You literally just like, hey, if they need it, supplements, if it makes them healthier, and almost like, you know, someone that would care a lot about their dog or cat, just take care of the animal so it's healthy.
Right.
For the most part.
And the only supplement.
And just let them do what they want.
Yeah. And I let them do what they want. In rotational grazing, we subdivide the pasture and we only give them access to a certain section of the pasture at a time. And that's really important. And, you know, if you've ever read about buffalo or bison, essentially to really distill it, rotational grazing just mimics what herds of bison used to do. And so you bring in the animals into a specific paddock, you let them graze that down to a certain point, and then you move them on to the next one. And the most important part of this process is the rest that you give that pasture that was just grazed, because it gives it time to regrow. The soil stays really healthy because the plant roots stay really healthy. The more leaf matter a plant has, the quicker it can regrow after grazing. And so rotational grazing is really the main way that we make sure these animals have a species appropriate diet for as long as we can.
This is really interesting to me because I have like a background in games and poker and stuff like that. And so does Colin, but it sounds like there's a lot of game theory involved in running a farm, which had not dawned on me until right now. That's kind of crazy.
You can nerd out pretty hard. And we do. I do. All my farmer friends who graze. It is. And we've had the most amazing grass growing season. Like, I could not be more happy. I have more grass than I know what to do with. And I don't think most of us are going to have to start feeding hay until December, which is kind of unprecedented. But it's fun. You know, we think about which forages are coming up. People have no idea how many species of grass and legumes and forbs there are. And, you know, each species prefers a different combination. Cows really love grass. Sheep love weeds. And then the goats really like what's called browse, which is trees and bushes and things like that. And so, yeah, you really, there's a lot of strategy involved in terms of what section of the farm I want to graze when. Am I grazing aggressively to get the plant growth down so that the next season forages have an opportunity to come up? It's, you can nerd out forever, basically.
Have you gotten to a point where you've maxed out the land use? Like, I, from what I've read about cattle, there's like a certain acreage where you probably can't put too much cattle on if you want them to be truly pasture raised. I assume the same would be for goats. Like, there's going to probably be like a restriction to how many animals you can have based on how many acres you have.
Yeah, that's called stock density. And so stock density applies, it applies to any species. You know, you, there's even stocking density with horses, technically, with any animal that you have. Yeah. And the stock density for goats in my neck of the woods is about 3 to 5 goats per acre. It's about 1 cow per acre. And that's in a relatively normal year. And as our weather patterns tend to fluctuate a little bit, you know, I could go to the high end and put 5 goats per acre, but then if we hit a drought all of a sudden, then I'm very quickly going to be overstocked. So I tend to be, and most farmers, I think, tend to keep it about 80% of what your stocking density could be. So there's lots of math calculations about how many cattle. And that's why this farm was kind of beat up when I bought it. He had 40 head of Limousine cows, which are very, very large framed animals, just continuously grazing the whole place.
So that brings us perfectly to how most beef, pork, chicken, whatever are raised and how you're doing it differently. Can you just speak on that a little bit?
Well, I think the more I dig into this, I think it's important to really distinguish between the beef industry, pork industry, and poultry industry. Like the production systems, the supply chains are incredibly different for each one. And that's kind of one of the things.
Well, how about beef?
Yeah, that we can stick.
Let's do beef.
We stick to beef. There are very interesting comparisons between the three. What most consumers don't understand about beef, and it's obvious to us if you raise cows, but we can't keep cattle in a confinement facility for their whole lives. They're very large animals. The amount of manure buildup we would have would be a huge problem. And so most beef production starts in a cow-calf operation on pasture. Most cows, and you know, this is where terminology is important, a cow is a female head of cattle that, you know, is bred to have calves each year, but most cows spend their whole life on pasture in cow-calf operations. And then it's only in the last 5 months of a steer's life, a steer's a castrated bull calf, that they go to the feedlot. And even at the feedlot, they're not eating as much grain as people think. And I know feedlots are where a lot of consumers have their contentions with beef, and I understand it. You know, a feedlot, I think there are a lot of feedlots that treat their animals well, which consumers don't typically accept. But there's a really big interest for these producers in keeping these animals in high welfare because there's certain things that can happen right before the butchering process that can affect the quality of the meat. If the animal's riled up, if it's been running, it doesn't hang right in the hanging process. The lactic acid doesn't process correctly. And it's what most butchers call dark cutters, where the meat's really dark. It's got an off texture and it's not really worth anything anymore. And so I think with feedlots, the issue for me is that that's not their natural environment. That's not ideally where they'd like to be. I think they're well fed. I think they have all the medical attention they could ever need. But for me, it's just a matter of this is not, they can't really express themselves. Like I see my cows scratching against trees. They roam around. They go into the bushes. They lay down and take naps. You know, they really kind of have the sweet life. They get to do what they want. And in feedlots, you know, they're largely in pens, which is not appealing to see. But I think I still eat feedlot meat. If I go out to a restaurant, a steakhouse, I still order a steak, even knowing it's from a feedlot sometimes for many reasons. One, because I don't necessarily think the welfare is as bad as a lot of people think it is when it comes to beef production. And two, I like to stay in touch with what the average consumer is doing. You know, I think it's very easy to kind of get in one lane and ignore all the others. But, you know, I live in a rural place. There's lots of food deserts here. I end up eating Sonic hot dogs sometimes just because that's all that there is. And that's the only choice I have, like in the middle of Oklahoma when I'm on my way to the butcher. I went way off on a tangent on that. But I think most cow-calf producers who sell conventionally to at the sale barn to a feedlot, I think they take really good care of their cows, honestly, because you have to keep a cow in really good condition for her to calve each year. And when they're feeding grain to their animals, sometimes they're feeding grain to cows to keep condition on them. But most of the time they're feeding grain to calves to get them up to weight, to take them to the sale barn so that a feedlot can purchase them from the sale barn, finish them at the feedlot and process them. Mm. What I think, surprisingly to most people, we need to kind of step up our game in the beef industry is pasture management. The same rotational grazing practices I'm using on my farm to maximize forage efficiency, a grain finisher could also use. Someone in a cow-calf operation could also manage their pastures with rotational grazing to maximize their forage efficiency, to increase carbon sequestration, to improve animal health. And so I think for me, it's not so much a welfare issue in the beef industry. It's more of a pasture management issue. Let's all manage our grass better and build better ecosystems where we're raising these cows.
Wouldn't that require more acreage and thus more cost?
You would think, but honestly, what happens with rotational grazing? So in a continuous grazing system, your forage efficiency is only about 30%. And I give people the buffet analogy. If I took you guys to Las Vegas in the buffet and I said, go crazy, eat whatever you want, you'd probably go for those high value items, right? You might go for lobster. You might go to the dessert bar. People would seek out the foods that they really like. And cattle are no different. If you turn cattle out on 40 acres, they're going to look for those forages they like most, things like crabgrass. They'd have a lot of protein. They taste really good. But if I took you to the buffet and made you wait outside and then brought you a plate and said, this is all you get to eat today, you're probably going to eat stuff on that plate that you wouldn't have chosen to eat otherwise, right? So with rotational grazing, instead of just giving them a buffet, you're giving them a plate and saying, you guys have to eat the grass that's in this paddock. And there's all different types of forages. And so they might end up eating Bermuda, which they don't typically really love to eat. And so by doing that, you can actually maximize your forage efficiency up to 75%. So they're actually eating 45% more grass than they would have if you just turned them out in a continuous grazing system. So you don't, it's really counterintuitive, right? Because you think, oh, I need more land. But by letting pastures rest and giving them time to regrow and forcing cattle to eat things that are still species appropriate, it's not like we're making them eat stuff that's going to make them sick. We're just kind of putting them to work now instead of just letting them be spoiled, do what they want. It's like, no, you have to eat these forages that you don't necessarily love.
So what about for the average consumer eating beef? Because you made a comment that you get a steak. I do the same thing. Like, obviously, if they have a grass-fed steak at a restaurant, I'm going to probably opt for that than a not grass-fed steak. But there's also some anecdotes that I've heard from, I think it was Primal Edge Health on YouTube. He was saying this family that he coaches or follows, they've been eating conventional supermarket beef their entire lives, the whole family. They're primarily carnivore, I think, and they're all in excellent health. And they never try to optimize for grass-fed or anything like that. And so that actually had me thinking a little bit that, you know, for most people, obviously getting off grains and sugar and all the things we know are not great, that's going to be a big step in the right direction. But what can the average consumer do when it comes to choosing the right beef and making better options? And like, you know, like you said, does it matter as much sometimes? Like, I still think people should try to opt for grass-fed, humanely raised, small farms just to support that. But I'm starting to open my mind a little bit to that. It's probably better to have meat than like a piece of bread anyways, whether it's the perfect piece of meat or not.
That's exactly where I come out on the issue, is that if I'm on a trip, if I'm traveling for work, if I'm at a conference, I'm not just going to eat bread rolls if there's steak being served. You know, I need protein. Sure. I function better as a human when I eat animal protein. And I think you're right. I tell people, buy local, go to the farm. And we have people come to our farm all the time and look at our animals.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. And I think they love that. And we send a weekly newsletter where we explain, here's what's happening on the farm. And we're always very candid. Like, this was a really crappy week. Here's why. That's the gold standard, I think. But, and this is where Diana Rogers, who we're working on Sacred Cow with, is much more well-versed in this. She's a dietitian. But nutritionally speaking, there aren't massive differences between typical feedlot beef and grass-fed beef. There are certain functional differences, but by and large, the nutrient density you get even from feedlot beef, I think, is a better choice. Me personally, especially, I think it's a better choice for me than saying, oh, I don't know where this steak came from, I'm just going to eat pasta.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you sound like you're way more open than other people I've seen. Cause like, you can probably see even in the grass-fed pastured movement and a lot of the permaculture movement, how it's like everyone else that does it differently is evil.
I hate that.
You see that a lot.
I hate that.
Right. So
I'm big in the regenerative agriculture and I study it and I talk to people, and it's, and even with rotational grazing. So there's 1,000 different names for grazing management plans. There's adaptive multi-paddock grazing, mob grazing, management intensive grazing, rotations. You guys, we're all trying to just maximize pasture efficiency, improve animal health, and increase our carcass weights. Like, we're all kind of trying to get to the same destination. And what works really well here in Northwest Arkansas, and I'm in the pasture belt, I've got it easy. Grass grows here winter and summer. But, you know, for a rangeland farm out in Montana where they've got 10,000 acres and a much different stocking density, maybe a different system is going to work. And it changes year to year. Our management changes year to year with as the seasons change. And so, yeah, I think I'm trying to get people to just calm down a bit. Like, let's not fight mm-hmm. one another so much. Let's just be unified in the fact that we're all trying to make better meat.
Hashtag goats of anarchy.
It's funny
no,
you say that.
No, hashtag goats of anarchy.
Because your article that kind of was the catalyst for the show is my beef with plant-based proteins half truths. So as someone who seems less dogmatic than maybe what I would have assumed you would have been about this stuff, can you speak on this article and maybe some of the points you're trying to make?
Yeah.
Especially when it comes to plant-based versus beef. And then for me, the big thing is like there's too much demonizing of a lot of the food industry and there's too much promotion of plant only. And I think plant only has a lot of issues itself. If you look at like pound for pound, like Brian from sapiens.org, he sent a study to me that showed the amount of animals by weight that die from just like clearing a field for a monocrop
yes.
is usually more than if you were to slaughter an animal and just live off that, like, let's say one cow for the year or whatever, right? Yes, it's like, yeah. it's crazy.
They don't like it when you bring that up to them. I can tell you that.
Of course.
And, you know, Diana gets into that a lot in Sacred Cow about, and most vegans will respond to that by saying it's the principle of do the least harm. And so they say, because mm-hmm. we didn't intend those field rabbit, and some of the, there's deer who just get maimed by combines. Like, it's wild, the kind of, and there's all the insect life that dies too. People, insects aren't cute.
And the ecosystems, like the wetlands and that have been like decimated from a lot of the monocropping that's done in the middle of the country. Like, it's right. yeah. really bad.
It is. So this article, I mean, I see plant-based stuff all the time. You have to be kind of under a rock to not see it. And as a journalist, yep. I just get irritated. And I'm not saying I'm like the be-all, end-all expert of agriculture, but as someone who can remember what it's like to be a completely rank green beginner consumer who doesn't like, there was a time in my life where I thought only bulls had horns. It's not true. You know, I used to be very much just your standard average consumer, but I've learned so much in 5 years about this industry that I've gotten to the point where I understand people who are writing about beef production have probably literally never seen a cow in real life. And it's yep, just,
or been on a farm even.
Yes. Or talk to a farmer, talk to someone who raises yep. cattle. And there's just so many assumptions. Yep. And what bothers me is these plant-based meat companies are playing into the fact that consumers are largely uneducated about food production. They're disconnected from the natural world. You know, death is a dirty word for everybody. We have so many people spend so much money on skincare to not ever look a day older. We just have this kind of struggle in our society with accepting that you're going to die. We all are. Everything is. Mm-hmm. And so I just kind of had to write about it and say, look, this is, you guys are only giving half of the picture. Like this Economist article that I responded to said that, you know, beef uses 80% of the world's agricultural land. But what they didn't include in that infographic is that that's land that can't be cropped. It's delicate, brittle. The soil is not great. It's rocky. It's really hilly. It's not ideal for crop production. So the ruminants that are there are actually helping to preserve that ecosystem. With well-managed grazing, mm-hmm. those ruminants can kind of bring certain forages back to life. They can deposit manure. They can enrich the soil. They can change the landscape for the better. And so I think it's just my way of trying to respond to the assumption that everyone's starting to have that cattle are always a negative consequence, and they're not. Ruminant animals are incredible in how they can change landscapes for the better.
What about climate change in cattle?
What about
because
it?
That's, you know, well, I've been seeing quotes that raising cattle contributes to like more than anything. And then I see something about transportation being the primary. And so like, have you dug into any of the misconceptions around how beef and then obviously Amazon rainforest, that's a hot topic because it's on social media. So everyone thinks that it's for cattle's the reason why, although that's just like a small piece of the puzzle,
right?
You know? So what are some of the big things that you've seen regarding beef and climate change? Because I think right now that's a big one that people are focusing on.
So I wrote what I call my opus of journalism back in March. And it's this really long investigative piece about how alternative protein startups get all the stats on livestock's carbon footprint wrong. And it all comes back to 2006 when the FAO released this report called Livestock's Long Shadow. And in that report, they concluded that livestock have more greenhouse gas impact than transport. And there's a researcher at UC Davis, Frank Mitlohner. He's on Twitter, GHG Guru. He's phenomenal. He's just this really impassioned German guy who will get you fired up about cows more than you ever knew you cared. And he dug into this research, and what he realized is that they didn't do a proper life cycle assessment. So instead of comparing the direct you know, burps of a cow to the direct tailpipe emissions of a car, they compared the entire life cycle of beef production to just the emissions of one car. So of course, beef production seemed higher. They didn't compare the fact that fossil fuel was extracted to power that car, mm-hmm. or the manufacturing processes, or the fact that that yep. was driving that car. And so Frank called bullshit and said, you guys are really misrepresenting this. And the UN FAO actually ended up correcting their research. And now if you look, it's really upsetting to me. I don't get it, because if you look at the EPA, livestock are just 3 to 4% of the United States greenhouse gas emissions. Agriculture mm-hmm. overall is 9%. Transport is like, I think, don't quote me, I think it's close to like 28%. And I don't,
yes,
yep. don't understand. We're driving around in cars. We're flying on planes. We're taking public transport. We have electric
oil tankers.
Yeah, we have
oil tankers shipping shit that we don't need.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We have all this disposable fast fashion, disposable stuff, plastic everywhere. But people go, oh my God, it's those cows. I know it. And that's what is starting. And that's why I wrote, I can send you this article too, because there's lots of data I wrote about how livestock are, yes, they do contribute greenhouse gases, but in a very negligible percentage compared to transportation industry. Another thing I'm starting to get fired up about is people's lawns, lawn care, and how they water their lawns. They put pesticide on their lawns, herbicides, and
cut it with a gasoline mower.
Yes. And then
whatever tractor.
And then it rains. And where does all that chemical runoff go? Right into the storm drain, right out into natural waterways. And it's like, stop pointing at cows and maybe look around you and have a moment of common sense. And I think unfortunately what it comes back to is that it's a lot easier for people to say, well, I want to change my carbon footprint. I guess I'll just stop eating meat, instead of changing their transport practices. I say, instead of meatless Monday, how about staycation summer, where you don't take some like wild European vacation, fly all over the place, stay in your own, do something like that to reduce your carbon footprint. And what I tell people all the time, Frank Mitlohner has this statistic where he said the consequence of going vegan for a year only has the effect of removing one one-way transatlantic flight. That's it.
That's a good stat.
Yeah, and if for comparison,
that's a way to think about it.
There's billions of flights every year. And so when you look in the grand scheme of things, that's just – and I think people don't understand that if you manage livestock, ruminant animals, not pigs and chickens necessarily, but if you manage – ruminant animals really well, they actually promote the carbon sequestration process underneath the soil. And that's what people
and replenish topsoil
yeah.
faster than even nature. I've heard like Joel Salatin, yes. I've heard can replenish like an inch a year or something, which is insane. Like faster than nature. Nature, I think, is like 50 to 100 years to replenish an inch of topsoil.
Right.
And it's like, there's just so much nonsense, but as true with anything that kind of is a mainstay in the collective pop culture consciousness, it's never the full picture.
No.
Right. It's never the full picture, right? Common sense, like Mark Twain, I think he said that he's misquoted a lot, but he's like, whenever I find myself on the side of the majority, it's time to pause and reflect. And I always think of that. I'm like, that's such a genius quote. That guy is so smart. Really, even though he probably didn't say it, because he's like the misquoted, most misquoted person.
I thought it was Abraham Lincoln that said
it. It might have been him, but it's like,
whoever said it was a genius.
But yeah. So there's just so much to dive into. And it's like, you listen to stuff like this, and the average consumer is not going to move to farm, right? But I try to tell people they should get to know their farmer, because there's yes. always a farmer's market almost anywhere you go, right? Like we buy beef from Bill at the local farmer's market in Austin, and he is biodynamic certified.
Yeah, biodynamic. Good for him.
Yeah, yeah. And so the beef, he's like one of the only in Austin, maybe in Texas. It's really hard to get, I guess, for cattle or something. But he does it. The beef's amazing, bright red, tastes amazing. That's what I feed my son. That's all we eat at home, right? And when we go and hang out with him, like on Saturday to get meat, we talk to him and we have a relationship. Mm-hmm. And in fact, we're going to go to the farm and do some filming like when it gets cooler out.
That's great.
Right? So it's like, that's a cool thing to do. It's fun. You make relationships or whatever, and you can really, really get in touch with where your food comes from. And I feel like that's probably the best thing for people to do. But aside from that, what can people do? Like maybe they want to, like you said, reduce their carbon footprint, or maybe they want to eat better for nutritional reasons or whatever. You know, like, I don't know. I don't know what the answer is. Like there's so many battles to fight and everyone has different ideas. I think the idea that beef is bad is the first thing that's got to go in the collective consciousness. I don't know if we're going to win that, you know?
Yeah.
But what can the average consumer do to either promote better meat purchasing and consumption, you know, or what have you thought about that a lot?
Yeah.
Or at all?
And I think it's hard, because I think for me, my knee jerk reaction is to take a negative tact. Whereas to, instead of explaining why they should eat beef, I start explaining to them why plant-based protein is so deeply misguided and actually going to be incredibly harmful for the environment. And I think most people think plants, beautiful, nature, organic, I will become a plant, mm-hmm. I'm one with nature. But I think they don't realize mm-hmm. how those plants are grown. And I don't think they realize mm-hmm. that chemical agriculture, it was just pervasively the way we grow our commodity crops, corn, soybean being the biggest two. Like, we have a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico the size of Connecticut due to fertilizer runoff from commodity crop operations connected to the Mississippi watershed. And it's like, yep. and but still, we point at these cows and go, they're farting too much. It's these cows. And so I try and explain to people that plant-based protein, whether it's peas or soy, is going to inherently rely on just more monocropping. And I'm not hearing any of these plant-based companies talk to me about how they intend to use regenerative practices to grow their billions of pounds. I don't know how much they're
going to do. They're not going to. They can't. They wouldn't have a business model for the most part. Right.
And that's what's infuriating to me, is that in the misleading information and the fact that so many consumers are just being taken advantage of so these companies can turn a profit. This is veggie burgers with lipstick. Like, I don't understand why people are saying, like, what a novel idea. Just eat plant. It's a veggie burger. Like, we've had veggie mm-hmm. burgers forever. But I think what helps me sleep at night, honestly, is that I don't think people are ever going to stop eating meat. And one study I recently saw is that 98% of the people who are buying plant-based protein are still buying conventional meat. There's very mm-hmm. few people that are completely swapping. And I also think, I was just in San Francisco for a regenerative agriculture investment forum. And it's interesting. I'm so rural now. Like, I've completely become a country bumpkin. And when I go to San Francisco, I feel like I'm 15 years in the future to some degree. and people really eat.
What are these scooters?
Yeah.
These scooters everywhere. There's no scooters in the town I'm moving to either.
No. And I can't. Yeah. I love to travel. You know, I grew up, I lived in San Francisco for a brief period. So I love to go back and experience it. But I usually can't wait to get back to my farm. But people are eating plant-based protein. And they don't know why. And I, you know, I'm always kind of an anthropologist when I go to these big cities. Like, why are you choosing that? And I'm always friendly. Because I'm not trying to pin them in a corner and scream at them about beef. I'm honestly just trying to get in the mind of the average consumer. I think it comes back to why I'm not as dogmatic about grazing practices, because I just want to understand where we're at and how we can move in the right direction. I think there's too many people who just like to stand and scream at everybody else. And like, let's ask questions. And that I wish consumers, instead of just accepting these alternative protein companies advertising, I wish they'd ask questions. Like, why is this soy burger better for me? How is it grown in a way that's better for the environment? And many of them have never stopped to ask, like, how is beef raised in the US? Because they assume that cattle just live their whole life in a feedlot, which is kind of impossible to do because of how big cattle are and just the space requirements. And if they were just in a feedlot, you'd have to feed them a ration all the time. And that's really difficult to do. And so something else, if I really am feeling kind of fired up, and I don't necessarily love doing this because I don't like picking on other industries, but from a welfare standpoint, I like to point out to people that cattle spend almost their entire life on pasture, especially if it's just a cow. Whereas pigs and poultry, it's high density confinement. And that's another thing this Economist article didn't point out, is like, yeah, cattle use more land because they're not in high density confinement in a grow house. Like, they're out mm-hmm. in their natural habitat. And to me, that's such a no-brainer now. But if I think 5 years ago, just being an average consumer, I guess I can see why that would be hard to understand. But I tell people, you know, if you've got a problem with meat, maybe don't eat as much poultry and pork for welfare reasons, or for the fact that we have these giant hog manure lagoons that we don't really know what to do with. And the hurricane comes in and now we've got just toxic sludge everywhere. So if I really kind of feel like being, I don't know what the right word is, antagonistic towards people about their choice of plant-based protein, that's kind of what I start to point out, is the realities and different production methodologies between different types of meat.
Do you think that ruminant animals are more sustainable than something like pork and chickens? Or can it just be done differently? You know, because like, obviously the scale of chickens compared to beef is like, we do, I think it's like 8 billion birds a year for chickens, nine. And that's just like, that is more than the human mind can even comprehend, right? Like, you can't really do that in pasture. We probably would have to reduce those numbers, you know? Like, is there a more sustainable way to do that? Or do you just think, I mean, I think from a nutritional perspective, beef is, and ruminant animals are always going to be better. There's just more nutrition there. You know.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And I kind of have to stay in my lane because ruminant animals are like my obsession and my love. And that's what I study and that's what I raise. I have some really good friends who do pasture-raised poultry. So the only thing I can offer is kind of anecdotal. And it seems like it's very doable. Like, there's a farm here across the mm-hmm. Creek Farm, Terrell Spence, He does a phenomenal job doing pastured poultry at scale. He supplies a lot of restaurants here, and his chicken's amazing. It's labor intensive because you're moving these birds in schooners on a daily basis almost. And what's funny, though, is that it all works together really beautifully. And we talk to Spence all the time because he'll tell us, he'll call us and say, I have Johnson grass up to my waist. And, you know, that's something our cattle and our livestock would just die for.
Do you bring them over there and you go eat them?
He doesn't have the right.
You bring them over there and they go great.
This is where we argue. He doesn't have the right fence for it. He doesn't have the right fence where he runs his schooners. And so we always say, you put some fence up, we'll drop some cows off. But then it's like, who's going to pay for the fence? Because it's land that he leases from a land trust. And so there's a little bit of a financial incentive that we kind of ping pong back and like, no, you pay for the fence. It's, you know, but you can have multi-species integrated grazing systems because what those birds do, they break up the parasite life cycle. So ruminant animals can get gut parasites that can end up actually killing them if they have too many, if they're not treated in time. But those birds scratch through the manure where those parasites thrive. They go behind it, they spread it, which helps the manure absorb down in the soil. It helps it act as a better fertilizer, and they break that parasite life cycle. So in an ideal system, what we would want to do is just graze our livestock behind those poultry schooners after that area's had a time to rest and regrow, because that chicken manure is incredible. That's why he has waist-high Johnson grass, you know, because that's such an amazing input. And I tell, when people say, let's just get rid of animal agriculture, I say, you're going to have to make so much synthetic fertilizer to put on crops.
Yeah.
And they don't realize that. And that creates greenhouse gas. And I think I listed a bunch of other stuff in that article that you found me off of about how if we get rid of animals, we're actually, I think one study says that we'll reduce our greenhouse gas emissions by like 2% if we got rid of all of animal agriculture, because people don't realize that cows eat agricultural byproducts. They eat corn stover. They eat this. There's one article from New Food Economy that really dug into it, how sometimes cows eat old Skittles. Like there's lots of food waste that is upcycled. Now that's not necessarily a species appropriate thing to eat. We could debate, should Bessie be eating Skittles? Probably not. I don't know. I'm not an animal nutritionist, but in a perfect world, you know, nature is a system. And I think where industrial agriculture, in terms of accomplishing yield and biosecurity, industrial agriculture excels. It's phenomenal. But I think now we're at a point in farming where we realize yield can't be the only metric we're driving towards. And I think that's bringing us back to a systems-based approach to farming. How can we integrate crops and livestock? How can we integrate different species of livestock? Mm-hmm. And that's harder to do. You know, chemical agriculture is largely plug and play. Pick your seed traits, plant it, spray these chemicals, harvest it this time. Whereas, you know, taking this holistic systems-based approach, you got to think far ahead in advance. You got to think on a daily basis. And, you know, things can go wrong. But that's true of any farming enterprise.
Well, and also though, short term, it might be plug and play, but as they deplete the soil and ruin the land, basically, it's not exactly long-term sustainable. And there's a couple of universities that I've been looking at that they are doing an organic test where they're growing organic and then they're growing conventional and they're comparing yields and things like that. And the organic is outproducing the conventional anyways, right? And, but like, you might have to do it a different way and you have to crop rotate and do things. So like, it's just one of those things. It's not as simple as it better. It's just better because it's easier or it's easier or whatever. You know, there's a lot to it to go deep. What I was curious about is, have you seen, because this is good for all the consumers, they want to learn about this stuff. Have you seen Big Little Farm?
I haven't. I don't watch a lot of TV.
So the second farmer we've talked to, I haven't seen that movie.
I know, like,
because we're busy farming. Farming is like,
yeah, I know, right?
Like when I come inside,
like, are you going to not watch the Breaking Bad movie tonight either?
No, probably.
I'm not going to watch
that. Probably not. Like when I'm done farming, I work all the time. Like I go out first thing in the morning.
You just want to sleep?
Yeah, I can't stay awake. I physically can't. And my boyfriend works nights. And so he's either gone or just in. I just can't. I have no one to force me to stay awake to watch stuff. So if it's 9 o'clock, good night. I'm done. I'll see like 5 minutes of a show and think, well, that looks interesting, and just go to bed.
Yeah. Well, that documentary is good to show you exactly what a mixed use, as close to nature as possible farm looks like.
Yeah.
And like for my farming aspirations, like I watched that and I'm like, I don't want to do that. That's a lot. And it took him like 7 years before it even like started working.
Right.
You know,
right.
I'm like, I want to do like do chickens for a little bit or see how it goes, or maybe some goats and sheep. But it is, I think, the future of food, if we want to really be sustainable and even solve a lot of the environmental issues, I think farming has to move away from like a few really big farms in mass ag to smaller, mixed, holistically managed, or however you want to say it, you know, crop rotating, pasture rotating farms that are much smaller and that provide food locally. I think that's the future, unless we can somehow through science solve it, which we're not there yet. It might take 20 or 30 years before we can really crack like the food generation problem. You know, I think that's the future. And so you're seeing a lot of these trends and everything, but
I want to mention I'm doing my part. I may not have ever told you this story, but my girlfriend moved here from Thailand 12 years ago and we started dating like 3 years ago. She never ate beef until she started dating me. But I took her to one of those Texas Day Brazil or like Fogo de Chao, like Brazilian steakhouses. And she's like, well, she saw all the meat like being dropped off on people's plates and they're eating them. They're talking about how delicious it is. She's like, can I just try that? Because she thought it was like a religious thing. It wasn't like a, like they were, her parents were Buddhist and they thought cows were sacred. Yeah. Sacred cow. I wonder if that's part of the title. But yeah, so she ate it. She's like, oh my God, this is so good.
Yeah.
And then that's it. That's the end of it. She,
so that's how you did your part. You got your girlfriend eat beef.
Yeah. Now she eats beef all the time.
Good
so
yeah.
Good job, Brent. Good job.
Tip the scale. Yeah. To your point, yep. I think about that a lot. You know, we obviously need a different food system. What is the solution and what's the path forward? And I think honestly, the reason I got to the point where I was not as dogmatic about things is because realistically, I don't think we're going to feed everyone. Like, I don't think we can have enough biodynamic, holistically managed farms in every single geographical location where we need them in the United States. One, because there's certain areas of the US where farming is just not going to be an easy thing to do. Like in really northern climates or really southern climates, like raising livestock in Florida is possible, but you're constantly fighting humidity, parasites, hot weather, hurricanes. And that's kind of where I got to the point where I said, do we really need to flip the whole system on its head? And through AgFunder and what I write about, there's an entirely new class of agriculture developing that's very bio-based. And there's startups who are developing crop inputs to replace synthetic chemicals that are based on the microbiome and how the microbiome interacts with plant roots. And so I'm really hopeful that there's a lot of technology that's going to help us still produce food at the scale we need to, because we've got 330 million people. That's, I don't know that we can feed 330 million people with small farms, realistically.
Well, the way we are used to eating three meals a day and snacking, whatever, you're right. I don't think it's going to happen either. But I know that we have, I don't know, 10 or 20 billion pounds of fat that everyone could just kind of dispel, right? And we could be eating less and fasting more and doing whatever. And I also think personally, yes, Brent, you have some fat dispel smell. We all know. So what I've been thinking about is when it comes to animal protein, because you have like the carnivore movement and et cetera, and all the ethics around it. I think humans should not eat meat every meal. I think some of our ancestors would have done that. It might be gene specific based on our ancestors, but some of the studies I've looked at, modern day hunter gatherers, like let's say there's a group in Africa, they go out to hunt monkeys, I think every day, but they're only successful like 10% of the time. And the rest of the time they're eating, I don't know, nuts and seeds, some tubers, maybe some small grubs and things here and there. But for the bulk of their diet, they're not sitting down to a very protein rich meal every meal. Right. Like it might be like 1 in 7 days where they just like gorge on meat. And so I think some kind of, we'd have to obviously change the perception of what we should be eating on a daily basis. We should be doing more things like fasting and just mixing it up. Protein fasting even, I think, is really good. There's a lot of health benefits to that, I think. So, you know, I think when it comes to sustainability, it's another one of those things, like there's a lot to it, right? Like there's a lot of variable to it.
Where I come to it though is from a logistics standpoint. Like our biggest, we could sell all the meat in the world. Our demand is through the roof. But our problem, our bottleneck is processing. There's only so many small scale livestock processors that we can have access to. And right now we drive 4 hours round trip to get our animals processed. And so I think where I just start to become pragmatic is like, okay, what pieces of our existing beef production chain can still be useful? And I think the processing side, we can raise grass-fed, 100% regeneratively grazed beef and still take it to a feedlot to have it processed and distributed throughout the country. You know, and I know that kind of bucks against people's preference for local food, but not every American. And moving to a rural state, a really rural place, kind of opened me to this. I mean, there's places in the middle of nowhere where their only grocery store is a Walmart neighborhood market, you know? And so I think it's just going to be hard to feed everyone on local food in the short term. Yeah, ideally, wonderfully, we'd have everyone buying from their local farmer, knowing their local farmer's name. But I kind of take the silver buckshot approach, not the silver bullet approach, where we're going to need a lot of different approaches to, like you said, change people's eating patterns. And I don't know if you saw Harvard, Harvard's healthy meal plate that they recently put out.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of drove me up a wall. I went on a little rant on Instagram about it, how they said, don't eat beef, but eat lots of fish or eat lots of grains.
Chicken, right?
Yes.
Fish and chicken,
yeah. I thought it was. Yeah. I mean, aquaculture has lots of issues that most people don't know about. And so it just, baffle me. And so I think I would love everyone to buy from a small farmer, but in the interim, I think we need to be pragmatic and say, what pieces of our food supply chain can we still retool to give people better food and to change how we produce food in this country to feed 330 million people?
Something that just came to my mind is the fact that I do buy from Bill. I get it frozen, right, at the farmer's market. And I still also buy beef boxes from a couple other suppliers around the country that sell good beef products. Now, when we, the local movement, maybe, I don't know when like that became a thing, but it seems like that was probably before we had like one day shipping options, right?
Yes.
So it's like, that is an option. And I think local is one of those words that it's not just about like the geographic to it, distance to you. It's also like, for me, the word local just means like small, not mass produced, not mass ag, not whatever, like by a small farmer that like really took care of his animals. To me, that's how I define local. I don't define local personally as like in Austin, Texas. If I can find it here, I want to do that because it's obviously my local economy. But I think that the second best option for people, if you do live in those places, is just to get a box shipped to you, you know, a box of stuff, whether it's a butcher box or Nose to Tail, Brian's company. I buy stuff from him.
Maybe a box know. From Wild Foods.
Well, we don't sell meat, but
not yet.
Everyone thinks
don't
you do
yet.
I know, right? I know.
Yeah, local's tricky. And I read a study a couple months ago where it asked a bunch of, it had like 1,000 consumers and said, hey, everybody define local. And the results were kind of terrifying as to, you know, the widely divergent perceptions of what local means. Some people thought local just meant the U.S. Right. You know, there's lots of different perceptions to it.
Yep.
Yeah, that is. The processing is the hardest part. And the reason that you probably still source meat from other places is that, you know, we butcher 40 steers a year, but, you know, that's only 40 briskets. And restaurants will call us and say, can you supply us with brisket for the year? And we're like, we can't. There's one brisket per animal, wow. And those fly out the door as soon as we get them.
Or like one tenderloin.
Yeah.
You know, it's like people think it just like grows on trees or something.
Oh, my favorite.
They don't realize like, you know.
My favorite is that people will call us to get a quarter or a half. And we'll say, okay, how do you want that cut? Because there's different ways you can cut stuff. And they say, we want it ground.
Mm-hmm.
You want it, the whole thing ground. And I wonder if
the whole thing.
I wonder if consumers just assume that like you cut a cow open and it's all just ground beef in there. Like if they don't understand, there's.
I mean, some people actually probably think that. Like you peel the skin back and it's like ground beef.
Some vegans, a bunch of them started tagging me, and there's some that tagged me that like post the number of felony arrests they've had as like badges of honor. And it's becoming a huge problem in Canada, from what I understand, that there was a rancher who had some people who were drug users. I think they were on meth and they were rifling through his car. And he yelled them at the door saying, get away from my car. And they wouldn't leave. And so he just fired two warning shots and a ricochet bullet ended up hitting one of the drug users who was stealing stuff out of his car in the arm. And the drug user is suing him in civil court for damages.
Oh, I've heard about that kind of stuff. Yeah, I've heard about that kind of
stuff. And maybe this is just, you know, my Arkansas kind of persuasion starting to seep in, but it's like, we're going to rob this guy and you got shot because you were robbing him while you were on drugs. And now you're suing him for civil damages. And some of the claims were things like emotional distress, PTSD, things like that, where he's like, I can't sleep as well anymore because you shot me. It's like, well, why did he shoot you?
Well, this is one of the great things about the internet and all the amazing people that get voices. In fact, I saw a clip today. I know this is off topic, but I think it was on the Oprah Network. It was a group of African-American overweight women that were blaming Trump and racism for not being able to lose weight.
That's it.
And they're basically saying that diets that work for white people don't work for black people, basically, is what they were claiming.
Well, they need to go vegan. I think they would lose lots of weight.
They hashtag go to anarchy.
Okay. Well, Lauren, I think it's a good place to wrap up. Okay. We really appreciate you coming on the show, and we're going to link to all these awesome articles. What was the name of that Opus article again? I want to link to that.
The name of the article is Alternative Protein Startups. Let's Get the Facts Straight About Livestock's Carbon Footprint. It's on AgFunder News. And then just a quick plug, Sacred Cow is an upcoming book and documentary project that Diana Rogers and Rob Wolf are working on, and that Diana's brought me in to do a lot of the blog writing and to help ramp up stuff for that. But the book is making the nutritional, environmental, and ethical case for why we need better meat and not no meat, and how, you know, ruminants are really part not only of our diet, but our, you know, ecosystem preservation, restoring soil.
Yep.
And we didn't talk much about the ethical side of should we kill animals for food. And I could talk about that forever. But the book gets into that too, about how vegans say it's speciesism, we don't own these animals. And what I tell people is, I accept that I'm a predator in this food chain. I'm just a progressive predator in the sense that I treat these animals really well and they die instantly. Like, they're not suffering.
Progressive predator.
Progressive predator.
That's the hashtag right there.
That's a new shirt. We got to get that. That's got to be a shirt.
Yeah. Yes.
So what we'll do is we'll have...
Diana kind of coined the phrase, it's not the cow, it's the how. How you manage these ruminants is really what impacts environmental impact. And so she was big on it's not the cow, it's the how. And Nicolette Hahn Niemann, who wrote Defending Beef, she talks about that a lot.
I just read that.
Yeah.
Yep, just read
phenomenal
that.
Book. Yep. She's great a fellow stuff. Lawyer. I love it.
Yep.
You know, don't make lawyers mad about their beef consumption because we will write whole books about it. But I tell people. But yeah, from the ethical standpoint, no matter what you eat, there's blood on your fork somewhere. Whether it's back in that field, an entire, you know, herd of deer that got maimed or something, there's something died for you to eat. So be a progressive predator and take responsibility for that and make choices that help you feel better about what you eat. Don't just stick your head in the sand about it.
Well, but even more so, the products you consume.
Right.
Like the amount of animals that die indirectly from like an iPhone production.
Yes.
People should actually dig into that. Like, it's probably more than beef ever was or will be or whatever. Like, there's so much. I mean, couches and this crap we get from China that we don't need. I mean,
yeah.
This is life though. Life, and we kill things. Like, for humans to live the way we live and do the things we've done on the planet, like billions and billions and billions of species have died and die every day, and like, it's just part of it. Like, that's the cost, right?
Yeah.
So unless you want to, you know, if you want to live, something's going to pretty much die as a result of
right
that.
And I write about that on Instagram a lot too. Like, I tell people things die so that other things can live, and to live is to die, and to die is to, like, it's certain. You can't be afraid of dying because it's going to happen to you, and you're probably, you don't just go to sleep usually and not wake up. Usually death is, even for humans, cancer, heart disease, diabetes, Alzheimer's, dementia, like, something's going to get you eventually. It's a nice cheery thought to leave.
None of those are going to get me. Yeah. And what do you think plants eat? Like, that's another thing that I was reading when I've read into it. It's like, plants eat animals for the most part, or what monocrops actually eat are fossil fuels, which then byproduct of those probably killed countless species and even humans, right? Like, look at what's going on in China and how many people die from just pollution and stuff. Right. But it sounds like we need to have you back on maybe when Sacred Cow comes out, and then we can like talk about all that stuff.
Yes.
You know,
I would love that. Yeah.
That would be awesome. And so again, thanks for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Where can people find you on Instagram? I want to get them over to you. I want to get you some love on Instagram because it sounds like you have plenty of the vegan hate. We need to get you some love to bounce that out.
You can follow me if you don't steal anything. So my farm name is White Hoof.
Oh, I just got it. Don't steal any of her physical property. You can steal anything. Her posts.
You repost my stuff. It's all very educational and it's all very candid and honest. And, you know, I tell people I was a consumer. I'm still learning, but let me show you every aspect. And I post some like really gruesome stuff about farming. But it's White Hoof Acres, just the color White Hoof Acres. I'm on Instagram. I don't do as much on Facebook because Facebook kind of wears me out sometimes. Or you can follow Diana at Sustainable Dish on Instagram, or go to www.sacredcow.info to learn more about the documentary.
We will have all those links below. So make sure you go over and support her and them, what they're doing with Sacred Cow as well. And Sustainable Dish, I've been following her for a while. That's Diana, right?
Diana Rogers, right.
Diana Rogers. Yep. Her account is one of those accounts that every time it pops up, I just hit like.
Yep.
Sometimes I don't even have to read it. I'm just like, I know this is going to be good. Okay. I'm going to like it. Okay. So that's going to be it for today. Make sure y'all like and subscribe over on iTunes, Spotify, etc. And we will see you on the next one. Thanks for listening to that show. Colin here, the Wild CEO. And I want you, if you haven't already, to go over to theancestralmind.com and download the 7 Principles of Living Wild PDF. You're going to hop on our Ancestral Mind newsletter. You're going to get the monthly Ancestral Mind newsletter, which is going to be full of content that's actionable, short, sweet, nothing too much, not too big of an investment of your time. You're also going to get every new show that we put out right in your inbox so you don't miss anything. You know, pick and choose. If you can't listen to every show, listen to every other or the ones that really strike your fancy. We have a lot more coming out, a lot more planned. So make sure you get over there at theancestralmind.com. And as always, if you have any questions or comments, you can send an email to me personally, colin@wildfoods.co. That's colin@wildfoods.co. And I look forward to hearing from you. I will see you on the next episode. Today's show is brought to you by Wild Foods Co. Real food, real ingredients from small suppliers around the world. Now, you've probably heard this ad before if you're a listener of the show. So instead of going into a broad view of the company, I want to talk to you about one of my favorite products, and it'll give you a glimpse into the way we do things, why we source things, how we choose products, how we choose ingredients, etc. And so one of these products is actually a culmination of a few other products that we sell. For example, our wild cocoa powder is the base, right? We also sell our wild turmeric powder. This is also in here. And so it's our wild cocotropic superfood cocoa drink mix. Now this product, you can drop in coffee, smoothies, shakes, you can even bake with it. It's a cocoa powder based product that has raw maca powder, turmeric, and then it's got the medicinal mushrooms that are added in to get that nootropic boost. And of course, all of those health benefits that you get from medicinal mushrooms. We have a chaga extract as well as a reishi mushroom extract. And so it's going to have mostly a cocoa flavor. And so you're not really going to taste the maca, the chaga, or the mushroom. So it's a really convenient way to get those mushrooms into your diet on a daily basis without having to down any bitter powders or take a bunch of caps or anything. This is one of my favorite ways to do this. It's one of our best sellers. People love it. Some people will put the cocotropic right into coffee and just blend it up. You can also, what I like to do, I add a little bit of grass-fed butter, some wild MCT oil, and then I add a tablespoon of cocotropic, and then I blend it up that way. And that just makes this delicious cocoa frothy mushroom beverage that, I mean, when you start waking up to that every morning, you just look forward to waking up for the day. It really is amazing. And so this is just one of the products that we offer that's based on whole food, raw food nutrition direct from nature, right? As close to nature as possible. We're taking premium, organic, in a lot of cases, ingredients, and we're putting them together to make this functional beverage for you that's just easy to take a scoop and add it in any way you see fit. It's just a really great product. And so this is something that we have in our pantry at all times. It's a really, really great starter and intro to something like butter coffee fasting or just having a little bit more functional nutrition in your smoothies or your shakes or your post-workout or whatever. So go check that out over at wildfoods.co and check out some of our other premium products. You know, examples include our collagen, our plant protein, our MCT oil, our wild fish oil, which is one of our best sellers. And you can learn more about all these products on the website, wildfoods.co. And so when you're ready to make a buying decision and get your first wild box, use code AMPODCAST12 for 12% off your entire order.
Please always remember that the members of the Ancestral Mind podcast are not, in fact, medical professionals. They're not doctors. They're not nutritionists. They are simply providing this entertainment for you to do your own research and to entertain yourselves. So please consult a physician before changing your diet. Not everything works for everybody. And make sure you always do your own research on everything you hear on this show and outside.